The Puppet Masters by Robert A. Heinlein. Copyright 1951 by Robert A. Heinlein and World Editions Incorporated. This unabridged recording of the reading of The Puppet Masters was published by arrangement with Spectrum Literary Agency and was produced in 1998 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book is read by Lloyd James. This book is 340 pages long. The Puppet Masters by Robert A. Heinlein. The following material appears on the book's back cover. At key points throughout North America, an invasion force is taking over communications, government, industry, and people's bodies. And the nation is helpless to stop it because the invaders multiply far faster than they can be destroyed, controlling the mind of every unsuspecting person they encounter. Enter Sam Cavanaugh, a can-do intelligence officer for the United States' most secret service. Cavanaugh is the only man who can stop the invaders. But to do that, he'll have to be invaded himself. One. Were they truly intelligent? By themselves, that is? I don't know. And I don't know how we can ever find out. I'm not a lab man. I'm an operator. With the Soviets, it seems certain they did not invent anything. They simply took the communist power for power's sake and extended it without any rotten liberal sentimentality, as the commissars put it. On the other hand, with animals, they were a good deal more than animal. It seems strange no longer to see dogs around. When we finally come to grips with them, there will be a few million dogs to avenge. And cats. For me, one particular cat. If they were not truly intelligent, I hope I never live to see us tangle with anything at all like them which is intelligent. I know who will lose. Me. You. The so-called human race. For me, it started much too early on July 12th, 07. With my phone shrilling in a frequency guaranteed to peel off the skull. I felt around my person, trying to find a thing to shut it off, then recalled that I had left it in my jacket across the room. All right, I growled. I hear you. Shut off that damn noise. Emergency, a voice said in my ear. Report in person. I told him what to do with his emergency. I'm on a 72-hour pass. Report to the old man, the voice persisted. At once. That was different. Moving. I acknowledged, and sat up with a jerk that hurt my eyeballs. I found myself facing a blonde. She was sitting up too and staring at me round-eyed. Who are you talking to? She demanded. I stared back, recalling with difficulty that I had seen her before. Me, talking? I stalled, while trying to think up a good lie, then, as I came wider awake, realized that it did not have to be a very good lie, as she could not possibly have heard the other half of the conversation. The sort of phone my section uses is not standard. The audio relay was buried surgically, under the skin, back of my left ear. Bone conduction. Sorry, babe, I went on. I had a nightmare. I often talk in my sleep. Sure you're all right? I'm fine. Now that I'm awake, I assured her, staggering a bit as I stood up. You go back to sleep. Well, she was breathing regularly, almost at once. I went into the bath, injected a quarter grain of gyro in my arm, then let the vibro shake me apart for 3 minutes while the drug put me back together. I stepped out a new man, or at least a good mock-up of one, and got my jacket. The blonde was snoring gently. I let my subconscious race back along its track, and realized with regret that I didn't know her a darn thing, so I left her. There was nothing in the apartment to give me away, or even to tell her who I was. I entered our section offices through a washroom booth in MacArthur Station. You won't find our offices in the phone lists. In fact, it doesn't exist. Probably I don't exist either. All is illusion. Another route is through a little hole-in-the-wall shop with a sign reading, Rare Stamps and Coins. Don't try that route either. They'll try to sell you a tuppenny black. Don't try any route. I told you, we don't exist, didn't I? There is one thing no head of a country can know, and that is, how good is his intelligence system? He finds out only by having it fail him. Hence, our section. Suspenders and belt. United Nations had never heard of us, nor had Central Intelligence, I think. I heard once that we were blanketed into an appropriation for the Department of Food Resources, but I would not know. I was paid in cash. All I really know about was the training I had received and the jobs the old man sent me on. Interesting jobs, some of them, if you don't care where you sleep, what you eat, nor how long you live. I've totaled 3 years behind the curtain. I can drink vodka without blinking and spit Russian like a cat, as well as Cantonese, Kurdish, and some other bad-tasting tongues. I'm prepared to say that they've got nothing behind the curtain that Paducah, Kentucky doesn't have bigger and better. Still, it's a living. If I had had any sense, I'd have quit and taken a working job. The only trouble with that would be that I wouldn't have been working for the old man any longer. That made the difference. Not that he was a soft boss. He was quite capable of saying, "Boys, we need to fertilize this oak tree. Just jump in that hole at its base and I'll cover you up." We'd have done it. Any of us would. And the old man would bury us alive, too, if he thought that there was as much as a 53% probability that it was the Tree of Liberty he was nourishing. He got up and limped toward me as I came in. I wondered again why he did not have that leg done over. Pride in how he had gotten the limp was my guess. Not that I would ever know. A person in the old man's position must enjoy his pride in secret. His profession does not allow for public approbation. His face split in a wicked smile. With his big hairless skull and his strong Roman nose, he looked like a cross between Satan and Punch of Punch and Judy. "Welcome, Sam," he said. "Sorry to get you out of bed." The deuce he was sorry. "I was on leave," I answered shortly. He was the old man, but leave is leave, and damned seldom. "No, but you still are. We're going on a vacation." I didn't trust his vacation, so I did not rise to the bait. "So my name is Sam," I answered. "What's my last name?" "Cavanaugh. And I'm your Uncle Charlie. Charles M. Cavanaugh, retired. Meet your sister, Mary." I had noticed that there was another person in the room, but it filed my one glance for future reference. When the old man is present, he gets full attention as long as he wants it. Now I looked over my sister more carefully, and then looked her over again. It was worth it. I could see why he had set us up as brother and sister if we were to do a job together. It would give him a trouble-free pattern. An indoctrinated agent can't break his assumed character any more than a professional actor can intentionally muff his lines. So this one I must treat as my sister. A dirty trick if I ever met one. A long, lean body, but unquestionably and pleasingly, mammalian. Good legs. Broad shoulders for a woman. Flaming, wavy red hair, and a real redhead saurian bony structure in her skull. Her face was handsome rather than beautiful. Her teeth were sharp and clean. She looked me over, as if I were a side of beef. I was not yet in character. I wanted to drop one wing and run in circles. It must have shown, for the old man said gently, "Tut-tut, Sammy. There's no incest in the Kavanaugh family. You were both carefully brought up by my favorite sister-in-law. Your sister dotes on you, and you are extremely fond of your sister, but in a healthy, clean-cut, sickeningly chivalrous, all-American boy sort of way." "As bad as that?" I asked, still looking at my sister. "Worse." "Oh, well. Howdy, sis. Glad to know you." She stuck out her hand. It was firm and seemed as strong as mine. "Hi, bud." Her voice was deep contralto, which was all I needed. Damn the old man. "I might add," the old man went on in the same gentle tones, "that you are so devoted to your sister that you would gladly die to protect her. I dislike to tell you so, Sammy, but your sister is a little more valuable, for the present at least, to the organization than you are." "Got it," I acknowledged. "Thanks for the polite qualification." "Now, Sammy, she's my favorite sister. I protect her from dogs and strange men. I don't have to be slapped with an axe. Okay, when do we start?" "Better stop over in cosmetics. I think they have a new face for you." "Make it a whole new head. See you." "Bye, sis." They did not quite do that, but they did fit my personal phone under the overhang of my skull and back, and then cemented hair over it. They dyed my hair to the same shade as that of my newly acquired sister, bleached my skin, and did things to my cheekbones and chin. The mirror showed me to be as good as an authentic redhead as sis. I looked at my hair and tried to recall what its natural shade had been way back when. Then I wondered if sis were what she seemed to be along those lines. I rather hoped so. Those teeth now. Stow it, Sammy. She's your sister. I put on the kit they gave me, and somebody handed me a jump bag, already packed. The old man had evidently been in cosmetics, too. His skull was now covered by crisp curls of a shade just between pink and white. They had done something to his face. For the life of me, I could not tell just what. But we were all three clearly related by blood. And we're all of that curious subrace, the redheads. "Come, Sammy," he said. "Time is short. I'll brief you in the car." We went out by a route I had not known about, and ended up on the north side launching platform, high above New Brooklyn and overlooking Manhattan Crater. I drove while the old man talked. Once we were out of local control, he told me to set it automatic on Des Moines, Iowa. Then I joined Mary and Uncle Charlie in the lounge. He gave us our personal histories briefly and filled in details to bring us up to date. "So here we are," he concluded. "A merry little family party. Tourists. And if we should happen to run into unusual events, that is how we will behave. As noisy, irresponsible tourists might." "But what is the problem?" I asked. "Or do we play this one entirely by ear?"
Possibly.
"Okay, but when you're dead, it's nice to know why you're dead. I always say. Hey, Mary?" Mary didn't answer. She had that quality, rare in babes and commendable, of not talking when she had nothing to say. The old man looked me over, his manner not that of a man who can't make up his mind, but rather as if he were judging me, as I was, at the moment, and feeding the newly acquired data into the machine between my ears. Presently he said, "Sam, you've heard of flying saucers." "Huh? Can't say that I have." "You've studied history. Come now." "You mean those? The flying saucer craze? Way back before the disorders? I thought you meant something recent and real. Those were mass hallucinations." "Were they?" "Well, weren't they? I haven't studied much statistical abnormal psychology, but I seem to remember an equation. The whole period was psychopathic. A man with all his gaskets tight would have been locked up." "But this present day is sane, eh?" "Oh, I wouldn't go so far as to say that." I pawed back through the unused drawers of my mind and found the answer I wanted. "I remember that equation now. Digby's evaluating integral for second and higher order data. It gave a 93.7% certainty that the flying saucer myth, after elimination of explained cases, was hallucination. I remember it because it was the first case of its type in the history of science, in which the instances had been systematically collected and evaluated. Some sort of a government project, God knows why." The old man looked benignly avuncular. "Brace yourself, Sammy. We are going to inspect a flying saucer today. Maybe we'll even saw off a piece for a souvenir, like true tourists." Two. "Seen a newscast lately?" the old man went on. I shook my head. Silly question, I'd been on leave. "Try it sometime," he suggested. "Lots of interesting things on the casts." "Never mind. 17 hours, he glanced at his finger watch and added, "and 23 minutes ago, an unidentified spaceship landed near Grinnell, Iowa. Type unknown, approximately disc shape and about 150 feet across. Origin unknown, but..." "Didn't they track a trajectory on it?" I interrupted. "They did not," he answered, spacing his words. "Here is a photo of it taken after landing by Space Station Beta." I looked it over and passed it to Mary. It was as unsatisfactory as a telephoto taken from 5,000 miles out usually is. Trees look like moss. A cloud shadow that loused up the best part of the pic. And a gray circle that might have been a disc-shaped spaceship, and could just as well have been an oil tank or a water reservoir. I wondered how many times we had bombed hydroponics plants in Siberia, mistaking them for atomic installations. Mary handed the pic back. I said, "Looks like a tent for a camp meeting to me. What else do we know?" "Nothing." "Nothing? After 17 hours? We ought to have agents pouring out of their ears." Yes. We did have. 2 within reach and 4 that were sent in. They failed to report back. I dislike losing agents, Sammy, especially with no results." Up to then, I had not stopped to wonder about the old man himself being risked on a job. It had not looked like a risk. But I had a sudden cold realization that the situation must be so serious that the old man had chosen to bet his own brain against the loss of the organization. For he was the section. Nobody who knew him doubted his guts, but they did not doubt his horse sense either. He knew his own value. He would not risk himself unless he believed coldly that it would take his own skill to swing it, and that the job had to be done. I felt suddenly chilly. Ordinarily, an agent has a duty to save his own neck in order to complete his mission and report back. On this job, it was the old man who must come back. And after him, Mary. I stood number 3 and was as expendable as a paperclip. I didn't like it. One agent made a partial report, the old man went on. He went in as a casual bystander, and reported by phone that it must be a spaceship, although he could not determine its motive power. We got the same thing from the newscasts. He then reported that the ship was opening, and that he was going to try to get closer, past the police lines. The last thing he said was, "Here they come. They are little creatures about..." And then he shut off. Little man. He said creatures. Peripheral reports. Plenty of them. The Des Moines Stereocasting Station reported the landing and sent mobile units in for spotcast. The pictures they sent out were all fairly long shots taken from the air. They showed nothing but a disc-shaped object. Then, for about 2 hours, no pictures and no news. Followed later by close-ups and a new news slant. The old man shut up. I said, "Well?" The whole thing was a hoax. The spaceship was a sheet metal and plastic fraud, built by two farm boys in some woods near their home, and the fake reports originated with an announcer with more sense of humor than good judgment, and who had put the boys up to it to make a story. He has been fired, and the latest invasion from outer space turns out to be a joke. I squirmed. So it's a hoax. But we lose 6 men. We're going to look for them? No, for we would not find them. We are going to try to find out why triangulation of this photograph... He held up the teleshot taken from the space station. Doesn't quite jive with the news reports, and why the Des Moines stereo station shut up for a while. Mary spoke up for the first time. I'd like to talk with those farm boys. I rode the car about 5 miles this side of Grinnell, and we started looking for the McLean farm. The news reports had named Vincent and George McLean as the culprits. It wasn't hard to find. At a fork in the road was a big sign, professional in appearance. This way to the spaceship. Shortly the road was parked both sides with duos and ground cars and trifibs. A couple of hastily built stands dispensed cold drinks and souvenirs at the turnoff into the McLean place. The state cop was directing traffic. "Pull up," directed the old man. "Might as well see the fun, eh?" "Right, Uncle Charlie," I agreed. The old man bounced out without a trace of limp, swinging his cane. I handed Mary out, and she snuggled up to me, grasping my arm. She looked up at me, managing to look both stupid and demure. "My, but you're strong, buddy." I wanted to slap her, but gave a self-conscious smirk instead. That poor little me routine, from an agent, from one of the old man's agents. A smile from a tiger. Uncle Charlie buzzed around, bothering state police, buttonholing people to give them unasked-for opinions, stopping to buy cigars at one of the stands, and in general giving a picture of a well-to-do, senile old fool out for a holiday. He turned back to us and waved a cigar at a state sergeant. "The inspector says the whole thing is a fraud, my dears. A prank thought up by some boys. Shall we go?" Mary looked disappointed. "No spaceship?" "There's a spaceship, if you want to call it that," the cop answered. "Just follow the suckers, and you'll find it. It's a sergeant, not inspector." Uncle Charlie pressed a cigar on him, and we set out across a pasture and into some woods. It cost $1 to get through the gate, and many of the potential suckers turned back. The path through the woods was rather deserted. I moved carefully, wishing for eyes in the back of my head instead of a phone. According to the book, 6 agents had gone down this path, and none had come back. I didn't want to make it 9. Uncle Charlie and Sis walked ahead, Mary chattering like a fool and somehow managing to be both shorter and younger than she had been on the trip out. We came to a clearing, and there was the spaceship. It was the proper size, more than 100 feet across, but it was put together out of light-gauge metal and cheap plastic, sprayed with aluminum. It was roughly the shape of 2 giant pie plates, face to face. Aside from that, it looked like nothing in particular. Nevertheless, Mary squealed. Oh, how exciting! A youngster, 18 or 19, with a permanent sunburn and a pimply face, stuck his head out of a sort of a hatch in the top of the monstrosity. "Care to see inside?" he called out. He added that it would be 50 cents apiece more, and Uncle Charlie shelled out. Mary hesitated at the hatch. Pimple Face was joined by what appeared to be his twin, and they started to hand her down in. She drew back, and I moved in fast, intending to do any handling myself. My reasons were 99% professional. I could feel danger all through the place. "It's dark in there," she quavered. "It's perfectly safe," the second young man said. "We've been taking sightseers through all day. I'm Vic McLean, one of the owners. Come on, lady." Uncle Charlie peered down the hatch, like a cautious mother hen. "Might be snakes in there," he decided. "Mary, I don't think you had better go in." "Nothing to fear," the first McLean said insistently. "It's safe as houses." "Just keep the money, gentlemen," Uncle Charlie glanced at his finger. "We're late as it is. Let's go, my dears." I followed them back up the path, my hackles up the whole way. We got back to the car, and I pulled out into the road. Once we were rolling, the old man said sharply, "Well, what did you see?" I countered with, "Any doubt about that first report? The one that broke off?" "None." "That thing over in the woods wouldn't have fooled an agent, even in the dark. That wasn't the ship he saw." "Of course not. What else?" "How much would you say that fake cost?" "That was new sheet metal, fresh paint, and from what I saw of the inside of the hatch, probably 1,000 feet, more or less, of lumber to brace it."
"Go on."
"Well, the McLean house hadn't been painted in years, not even the barn. The place had mortgage spelled all over it. If the boys were in on the gag, they didn't foot the bill." "Obviously. You, Mary?" "Uncle Charlie, did you notice the way they treated me?"
"Who?" I said sharply.
"Both the state sergeant and the 2 boys. When I used the sweet little bundle of sex routine, something should happen. Nothing did."
"They were all attentive," I objected.
"You don't understand. You can't understand. But I know. I always know. Something was wrong with them. They were dead inside. Harem guards, if you know what I mean."
"Hypnosis?" asked the old man.
"Possibly, or drugs, perhaps." She frowned and looked puzzled.
"Hmm," he answered.
"Sammy, take the next turn to the left. We're investigating a point about 2 miles south of here. The triangulated location by the pick?"
"What else?"
"But we didn't get there. First, it was a bridge out, and I didn't have room enough to make the car hop it. Quite aside from the small matter of traffic regulations for a duo on the ground. We circled to the south and came in again, the only remaining route. We were stopped by a highway cop and a detour sign. A brush fire, he told us. Go any further, and we would probably be impressed into firefighting. He didn't know, but what he ought to send me up to the fire lines anyhow. Mary waved her lashes and other things at him, and he relented. She pointed out that neither she nor Uncle Charlie could drive. A double lie. After we pulled away, I asked her, "How about that one?" "What about him?" "Harem guard." "Oh, my, no. A most attractive man." Her answer annoyed me. The old man vetoed taking to the air and making a pass over the triangulated spot. He said it was useless. We headed for Des Moines. Instead of parking at the toll gates, we paid to take the car into the city proper, and ended up at the main studios of Des Moines Stereo. Uncle Charlie blustered his way into the office of the general manager, us in tow. He told several lies, or perhaps Charles M. Cavanaugh was actually a big wheel with the Federal Communications Authority. How was I to know? Once inside and the door shut, he continued the big brass act. "Now, sir, what is all this nonsense about a spaceship hoax?" "Speak plainly, sir. I warn you, your license may depend on it." The manager was a little round-shouldered man, but he did not seem cowed, merely annoyed. "We've made a full explanation over the channels," he said. "We were victimized by one of our own people. The man has been discharged." "Hardly adequate, sir." The little man, Barnes, his name was, shrugged. "What do you expect? Shall we string him up by his thumbs?" Uncle Charlie pointed his cigar at him. "I warn you, sir, that I am not to be trifled with. I have been making an investigation of my own, and I am not convinced that two farm louts and a junior announcer could have pulled off this preposterous business. There was money in it, sir." "Yes, sir, money." "And where would I expect to find money?" "Here at the top." "Now tell me, sir, just what did you..." Mary had seated herself close to Barnes's desk. She had done something to her costume which exposed more skin, and her pose put me in mind of Goya's disrobed lady. She made a thumbs-down signal to the old man. Barnes should not have caught it. His attention appeared to be turned to the old man. But he did. He turned toward Mary, and his face went dead. He reached for his desk. "Sam, kill him," the old man rapped. I burned his legs off, and his trunk fell to the floor. It was a poor shot. I had intended to burn his belly. I stepped quickly to him and kicked his gun away from his still groping fingers. I was about to give him the coup de grace. A man burned that way is dead, but it takes him a while to die. When the old man snapped, "Don't touch him, Mary. Stand back." So we did. The old man sidled toward the body, like a cat cautiously investigating the unknown. Barnes gave a long, bubbling sigh and was quiet. Shock death. A gun burn doesn't bleed much. Not that much. The old man looked him over and poked him gently with his cane. "Boss," I said, "about time to get, isn't it?" Without looking around, he answered, "We're as safe here as anywhere. Safer, probably. This building may be swarming with them." "Swarming with what?" "How would I know?" "Swarming with whatever he was." He pointed at Barnes' body. "That's what I've got to find out." Mary gave a choked sob, the first honest feminine thing I'd known her to do, and gasped, "He's still breathing, look." The body lay face down. The back of the jacket heaved as if the chest were rising. The old man looked at it and poked at it with his cane. "Sam, come here." I came. "Strip it," he went on. "Use your gloves and be careful." "Booby trap?" "Shut up, use care." I don't know what he expected me to find, but he must have had a hunch that was close to truth. I think the bottom part of the old man's brain has a built-in integrator which arrives at a logical necessity from minimum facts, the way a museum Johnny reconstructs an extinct animal from a single bone. I took him at his word. First pulling on gloves, agent's gloves. I could have stirred boiling acid with my gloved hand, yet I could feel a coin in the dark and call heads or tails. Once gloved, I started to turn him over to undress him. The back was still heaving. I did not like the look of it. Unnatural. I placed a palm between the shoulder blades. A man's back is bone and muscle. This was jelly soft and undulating. I snatched my hand away. Without a word, Mary handed me a fancy pair of scissors from Barnes's desk. I took them and cut the jacket away. Presently, I folded it back, and we looked. Underneath the jacket, the body was dressed in a light singlet, almost transparent. Between the shirt and the skin, from the neck halfway down to the back, was something which was not flesh. A couple of inches thick, it gave the corpse a round-shouldered or slightly humped appearance. It pulsed like a jellyfish. As we watched, it slid slowly off the back, away from us. I reached out to peel up the singlet, to let us at it. My hand was knocked away by the old man's cane. "Make up your mind," I said, and rubbed my knuckles. He did not answer, but tucked the end of his cane under the bottom of the shirt and worried it up the trunk. The thing was uncovered. Grayish, faintly translucent, and shot through with darker structure. Shapeless. It reminded me of a giant clot of frog's eggs. It was clearly alive, for it pulsed and quivered and moved by flowing. As we watched, it flowed down into the space between Barnes's arm and chest, filled it, and stayed there, unable to go farther. "The poor devil," the old man said softly. "Huh? That?" "No, Barnes. Remind me to see to it that he gets the Purple Heart when this is over. If it ever is over." The old man straightened up and stumped around the room, as if he had forgotten completely the gray horror nestled in the crook of Barnes's arm. I drew back a bit and continued to stare at it, my gun ready. It could not move fast, it obviously could not fly, but I did not know what it could do, and I was not taking chances. Mary moved closer to me and pressed her shoulder against mine, as if for human comfort. I put my free arm around her. On a side table, there was an untidy stack of cans, the sort used for stereotapes. The old man took a double program can, spilled the reels on the floor, and came back with it. "This will do, I think." He placed the can on the floor, near the thing, and began shivving it with his cane, trying to irritate it into crawling into the can. Instead, it oozed back until it was almost entirely under the body. I grabbed the free arm and heaved what was left of Barnes away from the spot. The thing clung momentarily, then flopped to the floor. After that, under dear old Uncle Charlie's directions, Mary and I used our guns set at lowest power to force it by burning the floor close to it, into the can. We got it in, a close fit, and I slapped the cover on. The old man tucked the can under his arm. "On our way, my dears." On the way out, he paused in the partly open door to call out a parting to Barnes, then, after closing the door, stopped at the desk of Barnes's secretary. "I'll be seeing Mr. Barnes again tomorrow," he told her. "No, no appointment. I'll phone first. Out we went. Slow march. The old man with the can full of thing under his arm, and me with my ears cocked for alarms. Mary played the silly little moron with a running monologue. The old man even paused in the lobby, bought a cigar, and inquired directions, with bumbling, self-important good nature. Once in the car, he gave me directions, then cautioned me against driving fast. The directions led us into a garage. The old man sent for the manager and said to him, "Mr. Malone wants his car immediately." It was a signal I had occasion to use myself. Only then it had been Mr. Sheffield, who was in a hurry. I knew that the duo would cease to exist in about 20 minutes, save as anonymous spare parts in the service bins. The manager looked us over, then answered quietly, "Through that door over there." He sent the two mechanics in the room away on errands, and we ducked through the door. We ended up presently in the apartment of an elderly couple. There we became brunettes, and the old man got his bald head back. I acquired a mustache, which did nothing for my looks, but I was surprised to find that Mary looked as well dark as she had as a redhead. The Cavanaugh combination was dropped. Mary got a chic nurse's costume, and I togged out as a chauffeur, while the old man became our elderly, invalid employer, complete with shawl and temper tantrums. A car was waiting for us when we were ready. The trip back was no trouble. We could have remained the carrot-topped Cavanaughs. I kept the screen turned on to Des Moines, but if the cops had turned up the late Mr. Barnes, the newsboys hadn't heard about it. We went straight out to the old man's office. Straight as anyone can go, that is. And there we opened the can. The old man sent for Dr. Graves, the head of the section's biolab, and the job was done with handling equipment. We need not have bothered. What we needed were gas masks, not handling equipment. A stink of decaying organic matter, like the stench from a gangrenous wound, filled the room and forced us to slap the cover back on and speed up the blowers. Graves wrinkled his nose. "What in the world was that?" he demanded. "Puts me in mind of a dead baby." The old man was swearing softly. "You are to find out," he said. "Use handling equipment. Work it in suits in a germ-free compartment, and don't assume that it is dead." "If that is alive, I'm Queen Anne." "Maybe you are, but don't take chances. Here is all the help I can give. It's a parasite. It's capable of attaching itself to a host, such as a man, and controlling the host. It is almost certainly extraterrestrial in origin and metabolism." The lab boss sniffed. "Extraterrestrial parasite on a terrestrial host? Ridiculous. The body chemistries would be incompatible." The old man grunted. "Damn your theories. When we captured it, it was living on a man. If that means it has to be a terrestrial organism, show me where it fits into the scheme of things and where to look for its mates.